The Final Edition Radio Hour is a work of satire intended for people who own books, gentrify neighborhoods, and say they like kale. Please consume responsibly, the satire, that is.
Hi, I'm Jeff Chrysler, and I'm fake Tony Hendra. And this is the Final Edition Radio Hour. Fake Tony, I thought we weren't going to hear from you anymore. Well, it's a very exciting time. So exciting, it seems that you're in Australia. Where are you? Well, I'm on cloud nine. Because of all the great news, like the fact that that documentary about the National Lampoon, your National Lampoon, Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead, is opening nationwide and everyone should go see it this weekend or get it on iTunes or other places, that's one reason. And because the Final Edition Radio Hour can now be heard on iHeartRadio stations just by going to iHeartRadio and searching for the Final Edition. Yup, that's another. And because John Boehner resigned? Oh, so true. Your accent is killing me, Tony. But you know what? The resignation came after we already had our recording session. What are we going to do? Well, why don't we sprinkle some classic Boehner bits throughout the show as a little homage to the tanned one? That sounds great, Tony. I'm going to stop talking to you because your accent is painful both going in and coming out of my head. Everyone, as you're well aware, this is the Final Edition Radio Hour.
Martin Shkreli became the new most hated man on the internet after trying to raise the price of a life-saving drug, Daraprim, by 5,000%. The Final Edition asked the man on the street, what do you think?
Hey, that guy sounds like he's the pill.
Well, that's nothing. I just bought the rice to Dr. Gerton's nerve syrup and jacked up the price 2 bits.
You monster!
I think really deep down inside he just wants a hug.
I think deep down inside he wants $1 billion.
And a hug.
Leave Martin alone!
That Martin Shkreli looks like every kid in high school who used to try to jack up the pill from $13 to $750.
If you don't like it, why don't you move to Denmark where everyone's happy?
As long as he's not raising the price of date rape drugs.
I just want to punch Martin Shkreli in the face. I don't have a joke for this.
Was your baby born a girl or born a boy? Is he or she exhibiting gender confusion? Crying when being dressed in cute little dresses or cute little pants? Crying when being breastfed or not breastfed? Crying at night? Not crying at night? Just crying? We at Pre-K Gender Reassignment know that these annoying life-sapping behaviors can be catastrophic symptoms of your baby's struggle with his or her gender identity. She may have been born a girl, but inside she knows she's a boy. Just imagine the terror and misery racking that tiny body. Here at Pre-K Gender Reassignment, your baby's gender identity can be safely reassigned in less than an hour's microsurgery. And for those who require it, we have a Moyle on 24-hour standby. Nip the problem in the bud. Save your precious little one a lifetime of confusion, suicide attempts, online bullying, random beatings, self-mutilation, and hideous makeup fails. Because if you don't, that would be gendercide.
The following message is from the Political Action Committee supporting Jeb Bush, America Becoming Erect. During the last Republican debate, candidate Jeb Bush made the following statement.
As it relates to my brother, there's one thing I know for sure. He kept us safe.
That bold statement has been called the single most powerful moment in the history of debating by none other than Ronald Reagan. Of course, Jeb's words were mocked by liberal media outlets who claim that George Bush was president before and during 9/11. But that doesn't change the facts. After Nancy Pelosi drove those airplanes into the World Trade Center, George Bush vowed that never again would his people be attacked by radical liberalism. But he knew that to keep America safe, he needed a powerful surrogate. That's why he took the form of an American eagle and made love to Margaret Thatcher. She subsequently bore him a son, whom the angels named Jeb Bush.
But he's his brother, right? Or are you talking about George Sr.?
All three are different aspects of the same entity, which theologians refer to as the Bushhead. In his role as Jeb, he has protected America since 9/11 by patrolling the skies, riding a dragon he named Drogo.
From Game of Thrones?
That dragon is named Drogon.
But the horse guy that the blonde chick was married to was named Khal Drogo. The guy that looked like a super buff Dave Navarro.
Fine. The dragon's name is Similac.
Wait, isn't that...
Shut the fuck up! Since then, Jeb Bush has slain several giants and a cyclops, wrestled the Midgard serpent, descended into the underworld to rescue his beloved Eurydice, swallowed the moon, beat a steam drill in a spike-driving contest, batted safely in 56 consecutive games, became the first African-American woman to win an Emmy for Best Actress, slashed taxes for Florida residents by $19 billion, revolutionized the way we talk about corn, fucked your sister, and invented an alphabet for the Cherokee language. So vote for Jeb. He's president already. This message brought to you by America Becoming Erect.
I know. It's like some kind of baby food or something, right?
Good afternoon. I'm Brian Williams at MSNBC headquarters in New York. In just a few moments, Pope Francis will arrive in this country for the first time. As part of our live special coverage, we will bring you his arrival at Andrews Air Force Base as the leader of the Roman Catholic Church is greeted by the President and First Lady. Our senior White House correspondent, Chris Jansing, is there live for us, and she'll be reporting on all of it. And while we're waiting for Pope Francis, I just want to thank all of you for tuning in to see if I can climb out of the hole I've dug for myself. It's good to be back, even on cable. I'm sure when I said good afternoon just now, many of you didn't believe me. I want to thank my family and friends, and especially my agent, without whom I'd be doing commercials for reverse mortgages. I know you're all thinking, why couldn't I have just kept my hole shut, taking the $10 million a year and keep giving you nightly updates on Princess Kate's sister Pippa? Why did I try to be funny? Comedy is based in truth. On the downside, they're not giving me anything to do, so I think the whole point of this is just for you folks to enjoy hating my guts. Yes, I'm still incredibly wealthy, but what can I buy? Where can I go? What distractions can I give myself that won't kill the pain of the knowledge that I have zero credibility? Okay, I'm still good-looking. And there's booze. But I'm not stupid. I know I'm depressing the hell out of everyone here at MSNBC. Sure, people are nice to me, but what choice do they have? I could still get them fired. Okay, not to toot my own horn, but I've been on the air for almost 2 minutes, and so far everything I've told you is the truth. I know this isn't fair. I know there are thousands of news anchors far superior to me who will never get out of Wisconsin. We both know I should not have a job that requires describing things that actually happened. I hate myself. I really do. That's why I made up all that shit in the first place. On the bright side, I'm not Bill Cosby. And stepping off the plane, it's His Holiness Pope Francis. Over to you, Chris Jansing.
Have you been injured by a president? More specifically, have you been injured by a president who took executive actions because you yourself refused to take legislative action? Are you a moron, or have you just run out of ideas? I'm John Boehner for the law firm of Boehner & Boehner. We've been dedicated to suing the president since 2014. If you're upset about any part of the Affordable Care Act or other legislation, or just about the fact that the president is black, you may be entitled to a huge cash reward as well as impeachment proceedings. The Constitution's the limit. No, it isn't. Can we promise that everyone who sues the president will win? No. But we can promise that everyone who sues the president has a very good chance of fucking up the Democrats in the midterm elections, and that's just as good. Why am I doing this? Is it because I, too, fear my job will be taken away by some extreme nutbird the way it happened to Eric Cantor? I'd start crying, but I promised I wouldn't do that anymore. So if you're looking to soak democracy itself by taking steps that are stupid as well as disruptive, allow Boehner & Boehner to help you sue the pants off the black president.
So with allegations that the British Prime Minister had a youthful private encounter with a pig's head, setting the Twitter sphere buzzing, we go now live to the Palace of Westminster, where the venerable tradition of Prime Minister's Question Time is about to begin.
Leader of the Opposition, Mr. Jeremy Corbyn.
Mr. Speaker, question number one. Would my right honourable friend, the Prime Minister, admit that this has been a real pig of a week.
Oh, very funny. Not true, by the way, but, you know, I'm a good sport, so ha-ha.
Thank you, Prime Minister. Question number two. Would my right honourable friend say that his college antics concerning a pig were the pinnacle of youthful disregard for basic moral decency, or has he made rasher decisions?
Oh, look, I think that's enough, okay? It didn't happen. I think we all need to move on.
Question number three. Would the Prime Minister like to clear up once and for all? Was he simply pleased to see the pig, or was there a lardon in his pocket?
Now, steady on.
Did my right honourable friend buy the pig dinner first? Maybe a glass of swine? Was the pig hot to trot? Or would he say more hot to trotter?
Order, order. Next question. The MP for Cutteslaw Binkley, Cynthia Diggett.
As Hungary closes the border and thousands of Syrian refugees...
Sorry, but I wasn't quite finished with my line of questioning. Hate to hog the floor, but will the Prime Minister confirm whether the whole sorry incident was more of a pig in a poke or a poke in a pig?
There isn't a shred of truth to this rumour.
Will the Prime Minister admit he should have conducted himself with more deportment?
It was just a kiss.
In the words of Abraham Lincoln... Did the pig's teeth hurt?
I beg your pardon.
Did my right honourable friend have to use ointment? Or maybe call a ambulance?
We'll return to the seat of British power after these messages.
Do you like bacon?
Sure, sometimes.
Then
but...
come on and get your big, beefy bacon burger at Burger Busters. You get bacon, cheese, more bacon, a big, beefy burger containing bacon, cheese again, and two big bacon buns. Then you wash it down with bacon cola and a side of fried cheese with bacon.
Do you have anything vegetarian?
Sure, we have Thai salad with papaya and lime juice and bacon. It comes with a side of bacon orange juice and a bacon blueberry smoothie and bacon ice cubes and bacon Canadian bacon.
What if I don't want bacon?
Too bad! By order of the U.S. Congress, all food must now contain bacon!
What?
That's right! They couldn't pass filibuster reform, but they passed this!
This is a nightmare!
So come on down to Burger Busters for your federally mandated diet of bacon! Eat the goddamn bacon!
With luck, we'll be back with more of the Final Edition Radio Hour.
Pull up your pants, we're back! It's the Final Edition Radio Hour!
This is the community calendar for Orange County, California. Tonight, Lamplighter Pizza at 9 p.m., a middle-aged man in short pants will be drinking beer and loudly discussing Van Halen for 3 hours. That's Lamplighter Pizza, 9 p.m. to midnight. Thursday, 8 p.m. at the Tortoise Bar in Tustin, Emmeline from HR will say the Holocaust never happened. No one at Emmeline's table will know what she's talking about. That's 8 p.m., the Tortoise Bar. Friday at El Hacienda Restaurant in Costa Mesa, it's trivia night, as three men monopolize the conversation at their table, recalling pointless stories from high school. Their wives will want to kill themselves all night Friday at El Hacienda. That's this week's community calendar for Orange County, California.
Good morning, Holy Father. I'm Melanie Klingworth with ABC News. Thank you so much for being here.
Hello, Melanie. It's nice to meet you.
Well, it's an incredible thrill to meet you, Your Holiness. We just couldn't be happier that you agreed to an interview and that you chose ABC News.
I love your network. It is true. America has got talent. No way, that's NBC.
Your Holiness, just so you know, we'll be taping this interview and playing segments of it during our live coverage of your visit to the U.S. So this isn't live.
That is good. So if I mess up, you can stop the tape. But how can I make a mistake when I'm infallible?
Well, I don't see
Melanie, that was a joke. It's okay to laugh at the Pope.
Thank you, Your Holiness. Would you like something to drink? Forgive me, Father, I don't even know if I'm allowed to ask you about beverages.
Of course, my child. Like anybody else in God's creation, the Pope needs fluids.
Okay, would you like water? Tea? Wine?
Tea would be fine, thank you, Melanie. It's 8 in the morning.
Any particular kind of tea, Your Holiness?
Do you have chamomile?
Oh, I'm sure we do, Your Holiness.
Becca, some chamomile tea for the Pope!
Thank you, Becca.
And while we're waiting for your tea, Your Holiness, would you mind if we just started the interview? I know your time is limited.
Yes, you wouldn't believe how many of these I have to do today.
Your Holiness, could you tell me what message you hope to convey to the American people during your visit to our country?
Melanie, I wish first of all to say hello to the American people and thank you for allowing me to visit your wonderful United States. I hope to meet and talk with as many of you as my schedule will allow and take some of these selfies.
I can't tell you how many friends and relatives begged me to get them tickets to see you, but of course it was impossible.
Yeah, life is full of the disappointments.
And here's your tea, Holy Father.
Thank you, Melanie, and thank you, Becca.
Holy Father, forgive me for asking such a pointed question, but do you worry that some of your controversial statements about income inequality are causing a rift amongst Catholics?
No, because I speak from the heart, and I can only say what I find in there and what I know to be is the truth. Did anybody bother to heat the water up for this tea?
Becca! Come over here!
I'm so sorry, Your Holiness.
Don't worry about it.
Zap it for 1 minute!
I'm sorry, Your Holiness. She'll be right back. You recently said priests should forgive women who've had abortions. Do you worry that what you say will be misunderstood?
Melanie, like anybody else, I am but one of God's creatures. And I shall be judged as all people are judged.
But being the Pope, don't you
think... Let me finish my point. On the one hand, I am simply one of 8 billion souls here on Earth. On the other hand, I happen to be the Pope, so...
That's a big advantage?
I will hope so. Otherwise, how you say the joke is on me, but also you.
Here's your tea again.
Thank you, Becca.
Ah, damn, that's hot!
Oh my God, are you all right, Your Holiness?
That was my mistake, Melanie. I should have stirred the tea. But you didn't give me a spoon.
Can I get you some water, Your Holiness?
Yes, with ice, if you can manage it.
I'm so sorry, Your Holiness. You've been so gracious with your time.
And I have enjoyed myself, but now I've had it.
Here's your water, Holy Father.
Oh, look, there's no ice in it.
I think we're all just so nervous about meeting you. Plus, Becca's Catholic.
Isn't that lucky for us?
But we're so blessed to be in your presence, Your Holiness.
Becca is like myself. She has trouble understanding English.
Well, we may be making some changes soon. Anyway, thank you so very, very much, Holy Father. I will never forget this day.
I will say a prayer for you.
Will you really?
Well, a quick one.
I think we have more than enough for an interview.
Thank God. I was worried.
Street. Burger King has suggested collaborating on a new hamburger with McDonald's. The final edition asks the man on the street, what do you think?
Oh, there it is. See, first gay marriage, now this.
They should try putting a hot dog in a taco.
Yeah, I hear they're going to combine Ronald McDonald with Wendy and he's going to get arrested.
I heard KFC has approached Popeye's to produce more of the same shit.
Two all-beef patties, special sauce, and a bun, and a bunch of shit. I don't give a flying fuck what anybody does with their goddamn hamburgers. I just want my wife back.
Everybody poop now.
News from Washington. After Congress has filed a lawsuit and made rumblings about impeachment,
Many people are wondering why President Obama does not fire back more strongly. Well, today the president gave his reason. Congress has been using a human shield strategy, firing these scattered legal charges out of populated residential areas.
I know the strategy here. They'll hope I'll sue, causing collateral damage in, you know, surrounding areas. So Republicans can hold up civilian women and children and, you know, claim we hurt them intentionally.
House Speaker John Boehner disagreed.
We're not holding women and children hostage just because we're firing these various charges against the president out of maternity wards and preschools. The president does not fire back because he's weak and he has no plan and he knows it.
What if I told you the president is retaliating with countercharges against you right now?
This president is intentionally hurting women and children.
Yo, what the fuck is this?
It's called a line?
No, sweetheart. A line is what I'm gonna snort off your ass later. This is bullshit. Yo, the name's Cancer. With a C.
Ah, like the horoscope.
No, you moron. Like a disease. Didn't they teach you anything at fat camp?
Sorry, you're not on the list.
Not on the list? I'm motherfucking Cancer. I'm unfucking beatable. And now you want to tell me I'm not on the list?
That's what it says.
You want a piece of me, motherfucker? I'll give you a taste of my stage 3 specialty.
No, please. I'm sorry.
That's what I thought.
My mom had cancer.
No shit. Like mother, like daughter, huh?
Huh?
Get out of here. She'll be dead in a year.
So, Cancer, you got any kids?
No, but a whole lot of them got me. Don't you just love technology?
You're on Tinder?
Kinda. Except I swipe right if I want to give them cancer, and left if I don't. See? Yes. No. Yeah, definitely yes. Maybe if I get bored. What's life all about? I got no money, no wife, no hair. All I got is my sister leukemia, and she's a real cunt.
I remember you. 1983. You took my left ball.
Oh, yeah. Some of my best work.
You piece of shit.
Hey, no one comes near Mr. Cancer, understand?
Hey, man. I owe you one.
Yeah?
Yeah. No cancer for you till your 95th birthday.
Really?
Yeah. But you gotta promise me one thing.
Anything.
Lose some of that fucking weight. It's not healthy. Tell me now, baby, is it good to you? Can you do to you the things that I do?
I can take you home. They don't like it when I roll my R's. Here if I do it more. Next on the final edition.
Okay, I think you should do all of this.
What?
I'm just
you don't improvise, that you're telling me?
No, I can't improvise this. There's not enough substance to get my teeth into.
After these messages, the final edition radio hour will go to pi squared.
We will be right back after this.
Now do something French. Imagine drinking wine.
I just did.
We'll be back to discuss on the final edition radio hour.
Okay, these are incomprehensible. That's enough.
We'll be back soon with more of the Final Edition
Radio Hour!
Hi, welcome back to the Final Edition Radio Hour. I'm Tony Hendra. This week we're presenting part two of my interview with the legendary editor and essayist Lewis Lapham, in which we discuss various aspects of classic satire from George Carlin to Juvenal. I will let the interview speak for itself. At the moment, we are discussing Henry Kissinger and how best to treat him satirically.
It's much more devastating, I think, if you can approach Kissinger along those kinds of lines than if to call him a war criminal, because a war criminal, although true, is become such a cliched term.
Right.
And it's been used so loosely by people on both sides of the, you know, Republican-Democratic divide, that it's lost its force. We take war criminals seriously. The thing to do with somebody like Kissinger is to make him clearly a fool. And there's a lot of evidence.
Or a flunky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
No, I mean, the diminution of people is something that great satirists have always done.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a basic technique of satire, is to call, yes, as you said. I mean,
and that's not snark demeaning. It's just putting it in a perspective that holds the it's the emperor's new clothes. It's that kind of approach.
Right. You actually quote this from his autobiography: "What a king must suffer, for he knows deep down in his heart that he is a poor, cheap, wormy thing like the rest of us." A sarcasm.
Yeah. I mean, anybody with any degree of self-knowledge would know that.
Right.
But we, as a society, we flee from that kind of self-knowledge. We do everything we can not to be alone, but to be constantly on the cell phone, constantly absorbed, constantly distracted.
But we also want to be fulfilled, don't we, and empowered. And all these impossible words that mean really nothing except I want to be happier than I am right now.
Well, yeah, but that's something that if I don't mind saying so, that is your problem.
And right.
It is, of course, the problem that the advertising, the product people try to do for you, try to present you with. You can outsource your life to experts who will provide the proper accessories and put you through the correct routines and keep your mind on process and, God's sake, away from any night alone with your own thoughts.
Sure. And provide you with opinions.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So one thing that you said, reading Twain's autobiography, is to be reminded that in one way or another, the American is an improvisation, the character in a play of his or her own invention, hoping that the audience, fortunately consisting of actors as makeshift as oneself, will accept the performance as par.
Right.
I mean, that seems to me both a brilliant insight into Twain, but also suggests in... It may just be my hang-up with improvisation as a way to get at the truth, but it seems to me that that's part of the makeup of Twain and part of what he handed down to those who came after him.
Oh, well, yes. I mean, his life is a wonderful adventure and a constant improvisation. I mean, he starts as a youth in a small town in Missouri on the Mississippi River. Goes away to Philadelphia when he's still in his early teens and learns the work of a printer in a Philadelphia print shop. Comes back to Mississippi, goes into the, becomes a steamboat pilot. From his experience as a steamboat pilot, gives himself the pseudonym Mark Twain. And then comes the Civil War, and he has no truck with the Civil War. He's not going to fight on the Confederate side, nor is he going to fight on the Union side, so he goes to California. And goes through the experience of the silver mines in Nevada, becomes a newspaper writer both in Virginia City and in San Francisco. And he's always learning things firsthand, and he's not reading travel books.
You actually say here that he conversed with murderers and harlots. He learned the commonplaces of lust and corruption, violence and subornation. And cruelty.
Yeah.
A mise-en-scene in which a man who didn't see clearly didn't live long enough to hear the punchline.
That's true, yeah.
Which is certainly, you're not dealing with a version, someone else's version of these experiences.
No.
Or a camera's version.
And Twain continues all through his life. I mean, he's, again, as a lecturer, he improvises on stage. I mean, he doesn't, I'm sure he has some canned speech that he knows he's going to give, but he also can shift it to circumstances depends on the size of the room, the mood of the audience. He's always prepared to make it up. He traveled to Europe something like 80 times. I mean, he's constantly curious and he's constantly learning. He learns languages. He learns to converse in Italian, also in German, and he reads in those languages as well as in English. He has an enormous circle of acquaintance. He probably saw more of America, of 19th century America, than any other author of his generation. Not only saw more of the country, but knew more different kinds of people, not only the murderers and harlots in Nevada, but also a friend of John Hay, a friend of robber barons in Wall Street, friend of, you know, not necessarily friend, but acquainted with Teddy Roosevelt. And he was a man who touched the society at many of its surfaces. That's another thing that gives him the strength of his writing, because it's grounded in what he himself has seen and thought and maybe understood.
Yes, well, I mean, you make the point that Twain's understanding of the Constitution is not that it exists for the ambition of the state. I think you say that it exists for the for the independence of the individual.
Right.
And that Twain was mostly interested in his fellow citizens as citizens.
Yes.
Members of that body politic that ought to be.
Right. Not because, you know, one doesn't love one's fellow citizens because they're rich or famous, but because they are one's fellow citizens. And he actually understood that. I mean, he would have that same feeling. In the citizenship would be the President of the United States as well as the two-bit gambler. And
yeah, one of the, actually mentioning, I love that thing about Roosevelt, where Teddy Roosevelt, there was this horrible massacre in the Philippines of the Moros, where they were trapped in a crater.
They were trapped in the crater of a volcano, and the American military moved up. And within the crater, there were maybe 400 or 500 natives armed with a few of them, the men, women, and children, the men armed with machete knives. And but the American military situated itself on the around the overhanging edge of the cup and just shot them all with Gatling guns and rifles, murdered every single one of them. And for this magnificent show of military prowess, Roosevelt sent a telegram of congratulations to, I believe the man's name was General Leonard Wood,
right,
after whom there is still an important military base named, you know, somewhere in, I can't remember whether it's in Arizona or in Florida, but Twain was just appalled at that message.
He describes the president's joy over the splendid achievement of his fragrant pet, right, General Wood.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's where I, you know, borrowed the phrase to fragrant pet Petraeus. I mean, Petraeus, I mean, our military commanders, and I don't wish to disappoint you, Tony, but they're pretty third rate. And have
I've always
themselves.
Thought they were first rate. It's always been, you know, my conviction that they're really the top of the line.
They're not. And this is usually true at the beginning of any war. I mean, the people who were in command of the American Army going into World War II were, by and large, incompetent. And finally, you get some good line officers that come up through the ranks as NCOs or majors and show them, prove their worth on under fire. Same thing happened in the Civil War. I mean, the first five generals that Lincoln has leading the Army of the Potomac are popinjays, incompetents of one kind or another, and then Grant appears out of the swamps in Shiloh. And the other thing is, you know, we constantly talk about the magnificence of the American military, and American Army hasn't won a war since 1945.
And it arrived late.
Yeah, but again, I mean, the advertising is pretty.
Right.
But the advertising, of course, is in order to sell, in order to prosper the defense industry. We keep spending more and more money on weapons and on our military that is proven. Our military really is advertising. I mean, it's supposed to be, there it is. You see the carriers sailing into the ports in the Mediterranean or the Red Sea, and that's supposed to be enough to deter prospective enemies. The historian H. A. P. Taylor, marvelous British historian, wrote wonderful books about.
Yeah, I attended his classes at Cambridge.
You did?
Yeah.
Well, he once said, "The secret of being a great power, or of remaining a great power, is never to try to use the great power."
Right.
And every time we try to use it, it's just an embarrassment.
Yes. Get bogged down.
I mean, the invasion of Iraq after the Trade Towers was the people in Washington were talking about the demonstration effect. That was one of their favorite phrases, forward deterrence. And we will show the world that we are invincible. That was the whole. That was one of the lines of reasoning for the invasion in the Pentagon. And of course, they what they managed to do is prove the exact opposite.
Yeah,
you know, that's a misuse of one's military.
Yes, indeed. One of the things that I wanted to bring up, you make the parallel quite often in talking about Twain between his Gilded Age, which was a phrase he actually invented, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And our own. It's like a favorite theme of yours. One of the things that I've noticed in your writing, especially in the Bush years in Harper's, was that you frequently dropped into, well, I wouldn't say dropped into, but you frequently wrote in a manner which was not unlike Twain's in terms of being a commentator of great depth and flourish with the sort of memorable phrases. And one particular article which I dug up was a notebook, which was a front of the book feature of Harper's Magazine, and still is, I guess, which was entitled When in Rome. And it was written in January 2003, before Iraq had become the swamp that it later did. But the premise of the piece was that the Bush administration had, like other administrations, the Kennedy administration, for example, had started thinking of itself as Roman, and that you welcomed this, but you found it wanting in certain rather crucial areas. I found that to be splendid in many ways, but not the least because it was almost a Roman piece of satire. It was like a juvenile kind of level piece of analysis of the pretensions of these idiots. I mean, do you yourself, when you write in that mode, do you see yourself as a satirist in that same grand tradition?
Yes, sometimes I do. I mean, I'm a reader of Twain. I like to read Juvenal. I like to read Bierce.
And Mencken?
And Mencken and Mr. Dooley. Quite a number of them. I mean, Swift, Shakespeare is wonderful in that vein when he wants to be. So I don't do it consciously. A lot depends on, of course, what you read. My writing has never gathered much notice from the literary establishment in New York or in Washington. But,
right.
But that's because I think I'm working in a different tradition. I'm not reading the same things that they're reading. I sometimes think that the columnists for the New York Times only read the Atlantic magazine and their own paper.
Right, exactly, absolutely. So. I mean, I'm frustrated by this too. I was frustrated with Carlin, working with Carlin, because I regarded him as a major figure. And it was impossible to convince any of the coterie that you're describing of that fact. I mean, even though you could see in his work that it not only was it popular, but it was immensely influential. And it had all the right elements to convince people. And it rounds back to that thing of sort of trying to reduce dangerous satire or dangerous satirists to, as you say, an after-dinner speaker. And there was a rather wonderful quote. This is from David Brooks.
Right.
And David Brooks wrote a piece titled, I Am Not Charlie Hebdo, to which one answers, you are certainly not. But one of the analyses he has in here is that most of us don't actually engage in the sort of deliberately offensive humor that newspaper, meaning Charlie Hebdo, specializes in. We might have started out that way, he says. When you're 13, it seems daring and provocative to épater la bourgeoisie, which was a phrase invented, I believe, by Baudelaire when he was in his 20s, hardly a child. To stick a finger in the eye of authority, to ridicule other people's religious beliefs. But after a while, that seems puerile. And I'm reminded of a word that was constantly applied to the National Lampoon, that the stronger its satire got and the deeper it went, it was always described as sophomoric. We were constantly described as sophomoric. And Michael O'Donoghue, one of my co-editors there, once said that sophomoric is liberal for funny. Again, it's this diminution of anything that disturbs people to the point where they're having to confront their own prejudices or they're having to confront their own beliefs in a chimera. So he goes on to say, in most societies, this is wonderful, in most societies there's the adults table and there's the kids table. The people who read Le Monde, or the establishment organs, are at the adults table. The jesters, the holy fools, and people like Ann Coulter and Bill Maher are at the kids table. They're not granted complete respectability, but they are heard because in their unguided missile manner, they sometimes say necessary things that no one else is saying. I mean, to separate, I don't know, Mel Brooks, Lenny Bruce, Ambrose Bierce,
Yeah.
And put them all at the kids' table? And Robert Benchley sits at the kids' table? I mean, come on. It's just an extraordinary reflex they have, which seems to want to take the teeth out of what you write, what I write, what, Twain wrote.
Yeah, they are. And the adults table, that's because they spend so much of their time in the company of the good and the great, right? I mean, they interview President Obama. They go to dinner in Washington with Senator Kerry. They can't get any distance on the people they're writing about because they want to be thought of or think of themselves as part of the establishment, among themselves, among the good and the great. And when you want to belong to the club, then you have good table manners. You know, you speak politely to the waiters and you ask your dinner companion, who's presumably the chairman of a bank, you know.
Or the Secretary of the Treasury.
Secretary of the Treasury, whether he had a good day on the golf course. And he's, you know, he's a nice man. I mean, he presumably loves his wife. He doesn't throw himself out of windows. Or I actually remember Brooks writing a column once about that, about how unfair it was to pick on politicians because in private they were really such nice people. And that's probably true, but so what? The point is, what's important is their function in public. But the David Brookses of the world want to be part of the inner circle. They want to be the most pathetic, if you haven't read it, is a column I once wrote about the passing of Tim Russert. It was 2 days of mourning on the networks. Constantly, people were showing up. Tom Brokaw, I mean, everybody that, you know, was anybody in television news stopped by to shed a tear. And the letters of congratulation from people like, I don't know, secretaries of state and presidents of foreign countries and Bruce Springsteen and so forth and so on. And it was sickening because, you know, everybody's saying this is the greatest journalist of our time, and he was not. He might have been a nice man, but he never asked a hard question. He was there to facilitate the voice of power. He was not there to speak truth to power. He was there to pass along the wisdom of power to the American people. And that's what...
And perhaps to suggest some fine-tuning every now and then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Occasionally, essentially, he just was pouring butter on everybody's head. But occasionally, he'd add a little salt to the butter. That was his recipe.
Right, right.
God.
The Final Edition Radio Hour will be back in seconds.
And now, some more of the Final Edition Radio Hour.
Tony, we gotta come up with a promo. Our listeners don't know enough about all the great stuff the Final Edition does. Even when we tell them, it's all this, like, blah, 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 dot, 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 www, URL crap. No one gets what that is on radio. They just tune it out.
Well, I have the perfect way to hold their attention while we give them the goods. When I was at the National Lampoon in the 70s, our most famous cover had a cute mutt with a 38 Magnum to its head and the legend, "Buy this magazine or we'll shoot this dog."
Yeah, I remember that, but how does that help us? It was a visual image for a magazine.
Meet Freckles.
Freckles? Oh, there. Good boy.
Yay!
What's the matter then?
Also, meet my 38 Magnum.
Jesus Christ, you have a gun? Don't wave that thing around here. Is that thing loaded?
Sure is. Hey, listeners to the Final Edition Radio Hour on Progressive Voices on TuneIn. If you don't stay tuned to this promo while Jeff gives you all the necessary info about our fabulous website and our fabulous YouTube channel and other fabulous stuff we do, I will shoot this dog.
Jesus, man, take the gun out of that defenseless animal's ear.
Give him a good, Jeff.
Oh, my God, poor Freckles. Okay, fine. Hey, listeners to the Final Edition Radio Hour, you want more of what we do, go to thefinaledition.com. Our radio airs on this network on Saturday, Sunday, and Monday at 8, as well as Wednesday at midnight. We've also got an album, we've got a Twitter feed, we've got a great YouTube channel, Facebook, everything you can want at thefinaledition.com.
Now, tell them to tap all that into their iPhones or leave themselves an audio memo.
No, I won't. I told them enough, Tony. I'm calling yesterday.
Tell them, or the dog gets it. I'm cocking the gun right now.
Okay. Listeners, please, write this down. Thefinaledition.com. Thefinaledition.com. Go there. for everything you want from the final edition, or this crazy old British coot is going to plug old Freckles.
Okay, that wasn't so hard, was it? Come here, Freckles, you dumb old chump. Hey, hey, get down! Get down! Get away from me! Get you crazy cunt!
Good job, Freckles. Get him! Sick him! Oh, yeah, this is Jeff Chrysler for the final edition of Radio Hour on Progressive Voices on TuneIn. 8 p.m. Saturday, Sunday, and Monday nights. Midnight on Wednesday.
No, Freckles, put that thing down! You don't have opposable thumbs! No!
And now a word from the American Bushmeat Council.
Hey, Jim, what you eating?
Nothing. Leave me alone.
Oh, my God. Is that gorilla?
Not anymore. It's now brunch.
You monster! Give me that!
Let go of Coco!
Say, fellas, what's all the ruckus?
Who the hell are you?
Did you know the average American consumes over 80 pounds of meat every year?
Yes.
Of course you did, Jim. And we here at the American Bushmeat Council think you deserve more than just the usual slabs of crap laid out for you at the neighborhood Vons. Here, try one of these African brush-tailed porcupine kebabs.
Ow! Ow, 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 ow! It's so painfully delicious and endangered.
Is it endangered because it's so delicious, or so delicious because it's endangered?
Who cares? I've never tasted Gambian pouch rat like this before.
And you never will. That was the last one. Here, try some barbecued howler monkey. Hope you like it rare.
I usually take mine well done.
No, I mean rare as in there are only three left.
Hell yeah. Got any mozzarella?
Made from fresh platypus milk.
This is sickening. How could you possibly justify murdering and eating endangered species like Coco the gorilla?
Aw, cool down, fizzy lips. Maybe this word from Joseph Cotton will change your mind.
Coco never knew the real meaning of love. He just wanted everyone to love him. Love me. I'm Coco Foster Kane. Well, here's to love, Coco. Love on your own terms. Hey, nurse!
You know what? That cameo made almost as much sense as outlining the use of Tasmanian parachute spiders for bonbons.
I'm disappointed in you, Jim.
Why rain on everybody's rainforest, wise guy?
Yeah, why can't you just let me enjoy one of the few things I have left in my life that makes me happy? You know, besides my massive trust fund, and priceless baseball card collection, and in my intriguingly misshapen penis.
Well said, Jim.
Thank you.
So if you're tired of the same old trust fund, priceless baseball card collection, and intriguingly misshapen penis, why not eat a panda? Bushmeat, it's not just for starving Zulus anymore. This has been a message from the American Bushmeat Council.
Hey, nurse!
The final edition asked the man on the street, what do you think of the threat by an Ohio bartender to poison House Speaker John Boehner?
Well, drinking will kill you.
He didn't ask for a kamikaze.
I slipped something into Boehner's drink, but that's because I want to fuck him.
Hey, thank goodness Boehner has health care.
Right on, man.
Suddenly I feel like crying.
How can you poison Boehner? He is poison.
In the end, he just compromised and peed in it.
It's probably the first poison pill Boehner didn't work into a piece of legislation. Do you see what I'm saying? Because
trouble is, being dead in Cleveland is redundant.
Kids are gone. Hey, we could get high.
Why not?
Oh, wow, man. Hey, wow. Hey, do we still have an old comedy album? You know, the...
Oh, I think so. Good thing we no step in it.
Put it on.
Oh, wow, man. You just run a red light, man.
Oh, I thought it was an ambulance.
Oh, wow.
Oh, man.
What?
It's the police, man. It's the police.
Oh, wow. We got, like, all this PCP and, like, meth in the trunk, dude.
Eat this.
What?
Eat this, too. Eat this, too.
Good afternoon, sir. Can I see your license and registration, please? Do you know why I pulled you over?
Oh, wow. I shot him, man.
Hey, let's go to the drive-in, man.
Yeah, I think, like, Rosie's working.
Turn on the radio, man.
I'm Agnes Merriweather. Right now, the final edition takes you to Kensington Palace for an exclusive interview with Prince George, eldest son of the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge. George, your country is in a bit of an uproar over the Prime Minister.
That means fuck all to me, mate. I don't care about that twat.
That's a fairly crude response.
David Cameron fucks a dead pig and I'm the crude one.
That's just an allegation, and it was a long time ago.
Me mum always says to me, once a pig fucker, always a pig fucker.
I find it hard to believe your mom says that.
I'm just fucking with you, mate.
What about world figures? Are you aware of Donald Trump?
Yeah. Where do you get that hair? An orangutan's cunt.
Your great-grandmom recently celebrated being on the throne longer than Queen Victoria.
She's been on the toilet longer than Queen Victoria? Like me mum says, poop or get off the pot.
Have you had a chance to see your countrymen on late-night American TV?
I can't believe
John
our substitute
Oliver
teacher today
and James
Pope Francis.
Oh,
who knew
they're
he was so
countrymen,
into
all right. They are.
God, who cares?
So you don't much
chemistry
care for your
sucks.
Own patriots.
The Pope isn't going to change that.
The old wanker
Good morning,
geezer.
A student,
he snorted his
dad. I'm a Papa Frankie.
Do you like his new album?
I thought it would
What's
be
an
nice
album?
To visit
Thank
an
you,
American
Prince
school
George.
And teach one it. Of my favorite subjects.
Hi, Pope Francis.
Now, who can tell me what happens when you combine sodium with hydrochloric acid? Yes, young lady.
There's a chemical reaction, Your Holiness, sir. They create an explosion.
Correct, correct. It's almost as if God did not want these chemicals to be together.
Well, I'm not sure that...
But you know what I say. If these chemicals want to be together, let them go ahead and be together. Who are we to judge their explosion?
Caw, now you're speaking my language, Pope.
And then there are some elements that are normally combined, but would rather be apart. Take H2O, for example. Sometimes water doesn't work out. It drowns an old man in a bathtub or causes a leaky ceiling. Maybe that's because oxygen don't want to be with hydrogen no more. Maybe it wants to be with carbon now. Huh? Huh? And I think that's okay, too.
God, it's all making sense to me now.
Pope Francis, there are specific laws governing what can and cannot take place. Elements don't make decisions on their own.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize there was another infallible person in the room. Are you infallible?
No.
Oh, you're not?
Hey, Pope, I love your style.
Thank you, my child. Okay, on to serious things. I noticed some of you didn't do so well in your midterms.
Cough. That shit was crazy tough.
How about we say that test? It didn't count.
Oh, hell yeah!
What? No, I got a 98 on that exam.
My child, remember, unbridled ambition is like the dung of the devil. It builds with passion, but it will be released with fiery pain from the rear end.
Oh, zing! He told you!
Please, everyone, let's take out our chemistry books and turn to page...
Hi. Sorry I'm late. I had to take my friend to get an abortion.
I'll mark it excused. But you're still going to hell.
Hey, everyone. The documentary about the National Lampoon, Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant, Dead, opens nationwide on September 25th. thanks for listening to the Final Edition Radio Hour. The voices of the Final Edition are performed by Bruce Cherry, Jen Dodd, Jim Earle, Rob Gordon, Tony Hindra, Jeff Hendrick, Dan Vitale, Jeff Chrysler, Barry Lank, John Marshall, Abby Parker, Rachel Rauch, Steve Rosenfield, James Mount, Rob Miller, Kayla Merrill, Andrew Danish, Leslie Shapira, Anne Tuchel, and Darby Worley. Credit to our writers at the Final Edition Radio Hour, Bruce Cherry, Jen Dodd, Jim Earle, Rob Gordon, Tony Hindra, Jeff Hendrick, Abby Parker, Jeff Chrysler, John Marshall, Barry Lank, Leslie Shapira, Kurt Weitzman, Kate Knowles, Jeremy Rayburn, and Steve Rosenfield. The Final Edition is produced and directed by Tony Hindra and Jeff Chrysler, West Coast production by Barry Lank. Audio edited and engineered by Greg Russ and Andrew Hammond. The Final Edition Radio Hour is the property of the Final Edition LLC, copyright 2015. Thank you.